Good afternoon. This is Glenn Coble, and Scott and I are calling it a day. At least Scott is. He's heading out, and I'm going to take over with my program that's called A Progressive Life. And along that line, I thought today we were going to do something. It could be disaster. I hope not. As you know, I have a slight learning disability, dyslexia, slightly. So I don't read as well as I should. But one of the things that several audiences or several groups have done up in the northeast of the United States, in Massachusetts and in New York and in New Hampshire, Maine, all that area, they have made it an annual tradition to read Frederick Douglass's Fifth of July speech. And the speech is about what a former slave thinks of our Declaration of Independence. He did this speech back in 1856, which was, 5 years before the Civil War. He had been a free man since he was 28, and now he was 44, something like that. I'm not exactly sure, 46. Anyway, he escaped from his slavery in Maryland at age 20. And he had taught himself how to read, which was something that was absolutely verboten at the time. Slaves were not allowed to learn how to read. I guess the theory was if you keep them ignorant, they'll have to stay down on the farm, if you'll excuse the expression. Anyway, Frederick Douglass was the son of a black woman, and as was much the case in those days, a white man. It was against the law, but it happened a lot because of slavery. It was not a very, people didn't talk about it, but it happened all the time. Anyway, his speech was to a abolitionist group in Rochester, New York, which is where he ended up living, and it was a sewing club. An abolitionist sewing club that met, and they invited him to come do a speech. It was a female crowd that he was talking to, of course. He was a big suffragette. No, that would be the female version of it, but he believed in women's suffrage. And matter of fact, his wife at the time was a big suffragette. Anyway, he was asked to speak because he had spoken to many groups. He was a very learned man because he learned how to read using the Bible, using speeches from other people. And so he was quite eloquent for his age and for his time. Now, you've got to remember as I read this, there will be words that you don't understand, much like there were words that I didn't understand. I tried to look up most of them, but that was the way speeches were given back in those days. As a matter of fact, the Gettysburg Address, I think it's just a couple of minutes long, but the man who spoke before Lincoln was on for 2 hours in his speech. Now, this particular speech will go, it's about an hour, a little longer than an hour, but I'm not going to do it just today. I'm going to read the first half today, and then we'll read the second half tomorrow at 11 o'clock so that you can listen to it. Now, I understand there will be people that don't really want to listen to this, and I can understand, but I will try my very best I will remind you that I was an actor for a couple of years. One of the classes I had to take to become an actor was called Oral Interp, which was listening to or being able to read something and give some sort of interpretation to it. So I'm going to do my best, and if I fumble over some of these words, excuse me. But some of the sentences, some of the paragraphs you won't understand. That's okay. But if you can listen through the whole thing, you'll find gems. And this was, some people say, one of the finest speeches ever written and ever given about the subject of slavery. Mr. President, friends and fellow citizens, he who would address this audience without a quailing sensation has stronger nerves than I have. I do not remember ever to have appeared as a speaker before any assembly more shrinkingly, nor with greater distrust of my ability than I do this day. A feeling has crept over me, quite unfavorable to the exercise of my limited powers of speech. The task before me is one which requires much previous thought and study, for it is proper for the performance. I know that apologies of this sort are generally considered flat and unmeaning. I trust, however, that mine will not be so considered. Should I deem at ease, my appearance would much misrepresent me. The little experience I have had in addressing public meetings in country schoolhouses avails me nothing for the present occasion. The papers and placards say that I am a deliverer at a 4th of July oration. This certainly sounds large and out of the common way for me. It is true that I have often had the privilege to speak in this beautiful hall and to address many who now honor me with their presence. But neither their familiar faces nor the perfect gauge I think I have of Corinthian Hall seems to free me from embarrassment. The fact is, ladies and gentlemen, the distance between this platform and the slave plantation from which I escaped is considerable, and the difficulties to be overcome in getting from the latter to the former are by no means slight. That I am here today is, to me, a matter of astonishment as well as gratitude. You will not, therefore, be surprised if in what I have to say I evince no elaborate preparation, nor grace my speech with any high-sounding exterdum. With little experience and with less learning, I have been able to throw my thoughts hastily and imperfectly together, and trusting to your patience and generous indulgence, I will proceed to lay them before you. This, for the purpose of this celebration, is the 4th of July. It is the birthday of your nation's independence and of your political freedom. This to you is what the Passover was to the emancipated people of God. It carries your minds back to the day and to the act of your great deliverance, and to the signs and to the wonders associated with the act of that day. This celebration also marks the beginning of another year of your national life and reminds you that the Republic of America is now 76 years old. I am glad, fellow citizens, that your nation is so young. 76 years, though a good old age for a man, is but a mere speck in the life of a nation. 70 years is the allotted time for an individual man, but nations number their years by thousands. Accordingly, in this fact, you are even now only the beginning of your national career. still lingering in the period of childhood. I repeat, I am glad it is so. There is hope in the thought, and hope is much needed. Under the dark clouds which lower above the horizon, the eye of the reformer is met with the angry flashes portending disastrous times. But his heart may well beat lighter at the thought of America as a youngster, and that she is still in the impressionable stage of her existence. May he not hope that high lessons of wisdom or justice and of truth will yet give direction to her destiny. Were the nation older, were the patriots' hearts mightier, or be sadder, and the reformers' brow heavier, its future might be shrouded in gloom, and the hope of its prophets go out in sorrow. There is consolation in the thought that America is young. Great streams, not easily turned from channels, worn deep in the course of ages. They may sometimes rise in quiet and stately majesty and inundate the land, refreshing and fertilizing the earth with their mysterious properties. They may also rise in wrath and fury and bear away on their angry waves the accumulated wealth of years of toil and hardship. They, however, gradually flow back to the same old channel and flow on as severely or as serenely as ever. But while the river may not be turned aside, it may dry up and leaves nothing behind but the withered branch and the unsightly rock to howl in the abyss-sweeping wind, the sad tale of departed glory. As with rivers, so with nations. Fellow citizens, I shall not presume to dwell at length on the associations that cluster about this day. The simple story of it is that 76 years ago, the people of this country were British subjects. The style, the title of your sovereign people, in which you now glory, was not then born. You were, you were under the British crown. Your fathers esteemed the English government as the home government and England as the fatherland. This home government, you know, although a considerable distance from your home, did, in the exercise of its parental prerogatives, impose upon its colonial children such restraints, burdens, and limitations as in this mature judgment it deemed wise, right, and proper. But your fathers, who had not adopted the fashionable idea of this day, of the infallibility of the government, and of the absolute character of its acts, presumed to differ from the home government in respect to the wisdom and the justice of some of those burdens and restraints. They went so far, in their excitement, as to pronounce the measures of government unjust, unreasonable, and oppressive, and altogether such as ought to be quietly submitted to. I scarcely need say, fellow citizens, that my opinion of those measures fully accord with that of your fathers. Such a declaration of agreement on my part would not be worth much to anyone. I would certainly prove nothing as to what part I might have taken had I lived during that great controversy in 1776. To say now that America was right and England wrong is exceedingly easy. Everybody can say it. The dastard, not less than the noble brave, can flippantly descant on the tyranny of England towards the American colonies. It is fashionable to do so, but there was a time when a pronounce against England and in favor of the cause of the colonies tried men's souls. They who did so were accounted in their day plotters of mischief, agitators and rebels, dangerous men. To side with the right against the wrong, with the weak against the strong, and with the oppressed against the oppressor, here lies the merit, and the one which, of others, seems unfashionable in our day. The cause of liberty may be stabbed by the men who glory in the deeds of your fathers. But to proceed. Feeling themselves harshly and unjustly treated by the home government, your fathers, like men of honesty and men of spirit, earnestly sought redress. They petitioned and remonstrated. They did so in a decorous, respectful, and loyal manner. Their conduct was wholly unacceptable. This, however, did not answer the purpose. They saw themselves treated with the sovereign indifference, coldness, and scorn. They persevered. They were not the men to look back. As the sheet anchor takes, as the sheet anchor takes a firmer hold when the ship is tossed by a storm, so did the cause of your fathers grow stronger as it breasted the chilling blasts of kingly displeasure. The greatest and the best of British statesmen admitted its justice, and the loftiest eloquence of the British Senate came to its support. But with that blindness which seems to be unvaryingly characteristic of tyrants, such Pharaoh and his hosts were drowned in the Red Sea, the British government persisted in its extraction complained of. The madness of this course, we believe, is admitted now, even by England. But we fear the lesson is wholly lost on our present rulers. Oppression makes a wise man mad. Your fathers were wise men, and if they did not go mad, they became resistive under the treatment. They felt themselves the victims of grievous wrongs, wholly incurable in their colonial capacity. With brave men, there is always a remedy for oppression. Just here, the idea of total separation of the colonies from the crown was born. It was a startling idea, much more so than we at this distance of time regard it. The timid and the prudent, as has been intimated, of that day were, of course, shocked and alarmed by it. Such people lived then, had lived before, and will probably ever have a place on this planet, and their course in respect to any great change. No matter how great the good to be attained or the wrong to be redressed, may be calculated with as much precision as can be coursed of stars. They hate all changes, but silver, gold, and copper change. Of this sort of change, they are always strong in favor. These people were called Tories in the days of your fathers, and the appellation probably conveyed the same idea that is meant by more modern, though a somewhat less euphonious term, which we often find in our papers applied to some of the old politicians. Their opposition to then dangerous thought was earnest and powerful, but amid all their terror and affrighted vociferations against it, the alarming and revolutionary idea moved on, and the country with it. On the 2nd of July, 1776, the old Continental Congress, to the dismay of the lovers of ease and the worshippers of property, clothe that dreadful idea with all the authority of a national sanction. They did so in the form of a resolution, and as we seldom hit upon resolutions, drawn up in a day whose transparency is all equal to this. It may refresh your minds, and may my story if I read it. Resolved, that these united colonies are, and of right ought to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connections between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be dissolved. Citizens, your fathers made good that resolution. They succeeded, and today you reap the fruits of their success. The freedom gained in yours, and you, therefore, may properly celebrate this anniversary. The 4th of July is the first great fact in your nation's history, and the very ring bolt in the chain of your yet undeveloped destiny. Pride and patriotism, not less than gratitude, prompt you to celebrate and hold it in perpetual remembrance. I have said that the Declaration of Independence is the ring bolt to the chain of your nation's destiny. So, indeed, I regard it. The principles contained in that instrument are saving principles. Stand by those principles. Be true to them on all occasions, in all places, against all foe, and at whatever cost. From the round top of your ship of state, dark and threatening clouds may be seen. Heavy billows like mountains in the distance disclose to the leeward huge forms of flinty rocks. The bolt drawn, the chain broken, and all is lost. Cling to this day, cling to it, and to its principles, with the grasp of a storm-tossed mariner in a spar at midnight. The coining in being of a nation in any circumstance is the interesting event. But besides general considerations, there are particular circumstances which make the event of this republic an event of special attractiveness. The whole scene, as I look back to it, was simple, dignified, and sublime. The population of the country at the time stood at an insignificant number of 3 million. The country was poor in the munitions of war. The population was weak and scattered. The country at wilderness, unsubdued. There were then no means of concert and combination such as exist now. Neither stream nor lightning had been reduced to order and discipline. From the Potomac to the Delaware was a journey of many days. Under these and innumerable other disadvantages, your fathers declared for liberty and independence and triumphs. Fellow citizens, I am not wanting to respect for the fathers of this republic. The signers of the Declaration of Independence were brave men. They were great men, too great even to give fame to a great age. It does not often happen to a nation to raise at one time such a number of truly great men. The point from which I am compelled to view them is not, certainly, the most favorable. And yet I cannot contemplate their great deeds with less than admiration. They were statesmen, patriots, and heroes. And for the good they did and the principle that they contended for, I will unite with you to honor their memory. They loved their country better than their own private interests. And though this is not the highest form of human excellence, all will concede that it is a rare virtue, and that when it was exhibited, it ought to be commended and respect. He will, he who will intelligently lay down his life for his country is a man whom is not a human nature to despise. Your fathers staked their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor on the cause of their country. In their admiration of liberty, they lost sight of all their interests. They were peacemen, but they preferred revolution to peaceful submission to bondage. They were quiet men, but they did not shrink from the agitating against oppression. They showed forbearance, but that they knew it was limited. They believed in order, but not in the order of tyranny. With them, nothing was settled that was not right. With them, justice, liberty, and humanity were final, not slavery and oppression. You may well cherish the memory of such men. They were great in their day and generation. Their solid manhood stands out the more as we contrast it with these degenerative times. How circumspect, exact and proportionate were all their movements. How unlike the politicians of an hour. Their statesmen looked beyond the passing moment and stretched away in strength into the distant future. They seized upon eternal principles and set a glorious example for their defiance. Mark them. Fully appreciating the hardship to be encountered, firmly believing in the right of their cause, honorably inviting the scrutiny of an onlooking world, reverently appealed to heaven to attest to their sincerity, soundly comprehending the solemn responsibility they were about to assume, wisely measuring the terrible odds against them, your fathers, the fathers of this republic, did most deliberately, under the inspiration of a glorious patriotism and with a sublime faith in the great principles of justice and freedom, lay deep the cornerstone of the national superstructure which has risen and still rises in grandeur around you. Of this fundamental work, this day as an anniversary, our eyes are met with demonstrations of joyous enthusiasm. Banners and pennants wave exultantly in the breeze. The din of business, too, is hushed. Even mammon seems to have quit its grasp on the day. The ear-piercing fife and the stirring drum unite their accents with ascending peal of 1,000 church bells. Prayers are made, hymns are sung, and the sermons are preached in honor of this day, while the quick martial tramp of a great and multitudinous nation echo back by all the halls and the hills, valleys, and mountains of a vast continent, bespeak the occasion one of thrilling and universal interest, a nation's jubilee. Friends and citizens, I need not enter further into the cause which led to this anniversary. Many of you understand better than I do. You could instruct me in the regard of them. That is a branch of knowledge in which you feel perhaps a much deeper interest than your speaker. The cause which led to the separation of the colonies from the British crown have never lacked for tongue. They have always been taught in your common schools, narrated as at your firesides, unfolded from your pulpits, and thundered from your legislative halls, and are familiar to you as household words. They form the staple of your national poetry and eloquence. I remember, also, that, as a people, Americans are remarkably familiar with all facts which make in their own favor. This is esteemed by some of a nation's trait, perhaps a national weakness. It is a fact that whatever makes for the wealth or for the reputation of Americans and can be had cheap will be founded by Americans. I shall not be charged with slandering Americans. If I say I think Americans can side of any question may be safely left in American hands. I leave, therefore, the great deeds of your fathers to other gentlemen whose claims to have been regularly descended will be less likely to be disputed than mine. My business, if I have any here today, is with the present. The accepted time with God and his cause is the ever-living now. Trust no future, however pleasant. Let the dead pass buried in dead. Act in the living present. Heart within and God overhead. We have to do with the past only as we can make it useful in the present or to the future. To all aspiring motives, to noble deeds which can be gained from the past, we are welcome. But now is the time, the important time your fathers have lived, died, and have done their work for, and have done much of that as well. You live and must die, and you must do your work. You have no right to enjoy a child's share of labor of your father's use unless your children are to be blessed by your labors. You have no right to wear out and waste the hard-earned fame of your fathers to cover your indigence. Sidney Smith tells us that men seldom eulogize the wisdom and virtues of their fathers, but to excuse some folly of wickedness or of their own. The truth is not a doubtful one. There are illusions of its near and remote, ancient and modern. It was fashionable hundreds of years ago for the children of Jacob to boast, "We have Abraham to our father," when they had long Abraham's faith and spirit, and they had lost that. That people contend themselves under the shadow of Abraham's great name while they repudiate the deeds which his great name which made his name great. Need I remind you that a similar thing is being done all over the country today? Need I tell you that the Jews are not the only people who built the tombs of their prophets and garnished the sepulchres of the righteous? Washington could not die till he had broken the chains of his slaves. Yet his moment is built up by the price of human blood and the traitors in the bodies and souls of men. Shout, "We have Washington to our father." Alas, that should be so, yet so it is. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is oft interred with their bones. Fellow citizens, pardon me, allow me to ask, why am I called to speak here today? What have I, or those I represent, to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied the Declaration of Independence extended to us? And I, therefore, call upon to bring our humble offering to this national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude to the blessings resulting from your independence to us. Would to God, both your sakes and ours, that affirmation answers could be truthfully returned to those questioned. Then would my task be light, and my burden easy and delightful. For who is there so cold that a nation's sympathy could not warm him? Who's so obdurate and dead to claim the gratitude that would not thankfully acknowledge such priceless benefits? Who so stolid and selfish that would not give his voice to swell the hallelujahs of the nation's jubilee when the chains of servitude had been torn from his limbs. I am not that man. In a case like that, the dumb might eloquently speak, and the lame man leap as at a hart. But such is not the state of the case. I say it with a sad sense of disparity between us. I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessing in which you, this day, rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. The sunlight that brought life and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. This 4th July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice, I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems where inhuman mockery and sacrilege irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me as asking me to speak today? If so, there is a parallel to your conduct. And let me warn you that it is dangerous to copy the example of a nation whose crimes, towering up to heaven, were thrown down by the breath of the Almighty, burying that nation in irrecoverable ruin. I can today take up the plaintive lament of a peeled and woe-smitten people. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof. For there they that carry us away capture require us a strong song. And they who wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. Fellow citizens, above your nation, tumultuous joy, I hear the mournful wail of millions. Those chains, heavy and grievous yesterday, are today rendered more intolerable by the jubilee shouts that reach them. If I do forget, if I do not faithfully remember, those bleeding children of sorrow this day, may my right hand forget her cunning, and may my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. To forget them, to pass lightly over their wrongs, and to chime in with the popular theme would be treason, most scandalous and shocking, and would make me a reproach before God and the world. My subject, then, fellow citizens, is American slavery. I shall see this day and its popular characteristics from the slave's point of view. Standing there, I identify with the American bondman making his wrongs mine. I do not hesitate to declare with all my souls that the character and conduct of this nation never looked blacker to me than on this 4th of July. Whether we turn the declarations of the past or to the processions of the present, the conduct of the nation seems equally hideous and revolting. America is false to the past, false to the present, and solemnly binds herself to be false to the future. Standing with God and the crushed and bleeding slave on this occasion, I will, in the name of humanity, which is outraged, in the name of liberty, which is fettered, in the name of Constitution and the Bible, which are discarded and trampled upon, dare to call in question and to denounce with all the emphasis I can command, everything that serves to perpetuate slavery, the great sin and shame of America. I will not equivocate. I will not excuse. I will use the severest language I can command, and yet no one word shall escape me that any man whose judgment is not blind to prejudice or who is not at heart a slaveholder shall not confess to be right and just. But I fancy I will hear some of my audience say it is just in the circumstance that you and your brother abolitionists failed to make a favorable impression on the public mind. Would you argue more and denounce less? Would you persuade more and rebuke less? Your cause would be much more likely to succeed. But I submit, where all is plain, that there is nothing to be argued. The point in anti-slavery creed, will you have made an argument? For the present, it is enough to affirm the equal manhood of Negro man and Negro race. It is not astonishing that while we are plowing, planting, and reaping, using all kinds of mechanical tools, erecting houses, constructing bridges, building ships, working in metals of brass, iron, and copper, silver, and gold, that while we are reading, writing, and ciphering, acting as clerks, merchants, and secretaries, having among us lawyers, doctors, ministers, poets, authors, editors, orators, and teachers, that while we are engaged in all manner of enterprise common to other men, digging gold in California, capturing the whale in the Pacific, feeding the sheep and cattle on the hillside, living, moving, acting, and thinking, planning, living in families as husbands, wives, and children, and above all, confessing and worshiping the Christian God, and looking hopefully for life and immortality beyond the grave, we are called upon to prove that we are men. Would you have me argue that a man is entitled to liberty, that he is rightfully the owner of his own body? You have already declared it. Must I argue that the wrongfulness of slavery? Is it the question for Republicans? Is it to be settled by the rules of logic and argumentation as a matter beset with great difficulty, involved a doubtful application of the principles of justice, hard to be understood? How should I look today? In the presence of Americans dividing and subdividing a discourse to show that men have a natural right to freedom, speaking of it relatively and possessively, negatively and affirmatively, do not so would be to make myself ridiculous and to offer an insult to your understanding. There is not a man beneath the canopy of heaven that does not know that slavery is wrong for him. What am I to argue that I would make men brutes, to rob them of their liberty, to work them without wages, to keep them ignorant of their relationships to their fellow men, to beat them with sticks, and to flail their flesh with lash, to load their limbs with iron, to hunt them with dogs, to sell them at auction, and to sunder their families, to knock out their teeth, to burn their flesh, to starve them into obedience and submission to their masters. Must I argue that a system thus marked with blood and stained with pollution is wrong? No, I will not. I have better employment for my time and strength than such arguments would imply. What then remains to be argued? Is it that slavery is not divine? The God did not establish it? That our doctors or divinity are mistaken? There is a blasphemy in the thought that which is inhuman cannot be divine. Who can reason on such a proposition? They that can may. I cannot. The time for such argument is past. At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument, is needed. Had I the ability and could I reach the nation's ear, I would say on this day, pour out a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not right or light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the wind, whirlwind, and the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened, and the conscience of our nation must be roused. The property of the nation must be startled, and the hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed, and its crimes against God and man must be proclaimed. Go where you may, search where you will, roam through all the monarchies and the despotisms of the old world. Travel through South America. Search out every abuse. And when you have found the last, lay your facts by the side of everyday practices of this nation. And you will say with me that for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America reigns without a rival. We'll finish the rest of this tomorrow. I know it's a little heavy duty. I know the language is a little tough to understand, but I hope I gave you an insight of where Frederick Douglass came from 5 years before the Civil War. You're listening to A Progressive Life with Glenn Coble here on WWGH, and we appreciate you tuning in. We will do the second half of that tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour over on the air, which is the show that will be going on. And then tomorrow afternoon we'll have Swap Shop. I don't know if we'll be swapping, but we will have Swap Shop. But make sure you tune in tomorrow. I hope you can vaguely understand some of the problems that Frederick Douglass was facing at the time. Frederick Douglass, one of our great all-time.
You're leaders. Listening to WWGH Radio 107.1 LP, Marion, Ohio.